Norm's Conceptual Corner.
Good morning.
We are back.
Brittany's making fun of me.
Oh, you're very make a funnable.
Yeah, I'm having an interesting weekend. I just got hired by a school, and I'm in emergency mode, but we are going to talk about ethics anyway.
It's more fun.
Yeah, so I'm here with some of the usual suspects. Chal Moren.
Hello.
Nick Arcus.
Hello.
And Brittany Rose now is joining us.
Hello.
Good morning. So we've actually taken our sweet time producing this episode.
Have we said what it is yet?
No, we have not.
Trauma, we're burying the lead. This is a surprise.
Okay.
This episode is the continuation of our discussion on social contract as far as a moral theory, better known as contractualism or contractarianism. Apparently, there is a difference between the two. Even it's not just in name.
It's also spelled differently, too.
It's spelled differently, right?
One more A.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm finding as I am becoming a science teacher that I am not as seduced by philosophy as I used to be. And I think that that's going to actually work out well today. I do think that understanding social contract is worthwhile because it, for better or worse, is kind of the foundation of how we do things. But the end of last episode, even though it's been a long time, we said that we were going to spend more time talking about the main objections to the idea and trying to defend them or just live with them or whatever.
Because yeah. we didn't really get into any of them.
Yeah.
We briefly talked about a few.
We didn't have much time.
No.
So I don't know what my expectations are for this episode. I suspect that we're going to have some differences of opinion, which is fine. But let's just kind of recap so that we can all get to where you know we need to go. The idea of social contract being that morality is created by people, and it can be created implicitly or expressly, but it's created. It's not real. It's a way of looking at the world that you kind of intentionally put on or train other people in. You know, for example, teachers and parents train children and this kind of stuff. And it's supposed to be for a particular purpose, solving a particular problem of human behavior or just the human situation. And that is supposed to explain how morality works, what justifies the moral rules that we have, and what they're intending to do. So that's the general overview in real broad terms. Specifically, the idea of contract, of social contract that we've been looking at has been a solution to the problem of kind of a hybrid of human selfishness and the need to work with other people. If you were completely selfish, as in had no concern for other people, well, then you're not going to actually be able to function very well with other people. And, you know, you're not going to end up living around them. Maybe not end up living very long at all.
Well, even if you are extremely selfish, you could still participate in social contract in the pursuit of your needs.
Right.
So it's not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily defeat the idea.
No, but the more selfish you are, the more difficult it is going to be to work with other people.
That's a key for me because I think the entire reason we need morality is because we have to live with other people.
Right.
Human beings can't survive on our own. I mean, we have to have some way of cooperating. Otherwise, you know, the species will just die.
Right.
I mean, unlike a lot of animals and creatures on the planet, whenever we're born, we're completely helpless.
Completely dependent on others.
You know, there are some creatures that are good to go the moment they're born or within hours, but we're not. So we need other people. So, I mean, evolution, you know, natural selection kind of creates these innate tendencies or like we have, you know, emotional bonds where we have the ability to empathize with other people.
Right.
It lays this foundation that allows us to interact socially with one another. I feel like morality emerges out of that. Right. We have this condition where we have to live together. You know, evolution has created mechanisms that allow us to do it. And I think morality is more of a codified or reasoned out version of that once, you know, once you reach a certain point
right.
in human development.
And maybe having to live together is just a little bit strong. I imagine somebody now could go off and live completely on their own if they had the right survival skills.
They yeah. could, but how do you get there, though? Someone had to.
I mean,
unless we're like talking Tarzan theory where they're raised by the wolves.
Yeah, people, that guy would have to learn how to survive from information from other people, use tools made by other people, yeah.
I think the fact that this hypothetical person, if they're super selfish, if they want to survive and do well, then they're forced to at least consider other people.
Yeah.
You know, just out of selfishness.
Yeah.
To survive.
So, was it Ted Kaczynski? Didn't he live alone for a very long time? You guys know anything about Ted Kaczynski?
Well, he had a problem mailing things to people.
Unabomber.
Huh? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he had a problem mailing things to people.
Yes.
He lived out in the woods.
In the shed.
Yes, this with no running water.
Mm-hmm. It was a shed.
Right. But he was still dependent on other people because he got things sent to him from the mail. He sent things in the mail. That's interacting with other people. He didn't like other people. In fact, apparently the reason why he got off on his own was to just get away from everybody. And he was annoyed when he saw a plane fly by because he knew there were people in it and thought, I can't get away from everybody. So yeah. It's kind of crazy, but still.
It's like an extreme Daniel Boone and it's elbow room.
Right, right.
I kind of agree with Nick about the idea that morality has an evolutionary basis, but from an evolutionary perspective, the tendencies that we have evolved aren't necessarily going to fit modern social situations.
Well, no, that's why morality is important, because you also have what people call human nature. They usually think, anytime you say, well, that's just human nature, they're usually talking about the darker aspects of it.
Right.
But those are also things that were probably useful for survival. But right. morality, though, allows us to kind of control that aspect, though.
So I would say it's not necessarily codified moral instinct, because there are potentially any number of social programs we could end up with that would facilitate survival.
Right.
This is just the one that's suited to our species at the moment, or was suited to our species in a pre-agricultural.
I think it still is pretty clearly. I think we are even more dependent on each other than we used to be.
Right. I think it creates new scenarios, new interactions, sure. new expectations.
Sure. So, what's interesting is that you mentioned that there are evolutionary instincts, maybe emotions would be a good way to put that. And I think that's going to play a part in the main objection.
Yes.
So
me too. Yeah.
So, okay, look, happy fun times. We all, actually, I don't know, Brittany, if you buy Social Contract or not. I'm not going to directly ask you, but I suspect that you're not really much of a fan.
No, not really.
Yeah.
Honestly, any sort of moral, any one of the contractualism, I feel like anytime you try to make a structure out of moral thought, it's mm-hmm. going to go against human nature. It's going to go against what it is that we actually all want to do.
Gotcha.
And as much as you want to say that let's all be good people and let's all be nice and care about one another, overall it's not going to work out. If you try to make a structure that is based on that, it's counterintuitive to what we want to do.
I gotcha.
Not saying that we shouldn't. I'm just saying that it's going to fail.
But yeah. I see, this is actually what I think is, for me, one of the strengths of Social Contract is that I feel like it allows us to work with the flow instead of having us go against
it. It seems like a systematic
effort.
It's not
excessively demanding.
Right. Yeah. So I think that's important, though. I mean, one of the main things I object to utilitarianism for is that I feel like it really wants us to swim upstream.
Right.
Unnecessarily so. I feel like Social Contract shows you a way that you can go with the flow and still be good. And it doesn't demand so much that it feels like it's going against a lot of those things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that might not be a great reason necessarily for it. I mean, maybe utilitarianism is correct anyways.
Mm-hmm.
But I just kind of think that if you can, from a practical implementing it standpoint, it's easier if you can demand less and still get good results.
Yeah. I'm going to go back to something that you said, Brittany. I think one of the things that's kind of weird about moral philosophy is that it doesn't matter if the system works or not. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's nice if it does. But moral philosophy is not kind of codifying, the way people actually behave. It's simply trying to systematize a way of talking about how people behave.
Mm-hmm.
And it, if people don't behave that way, that's totally totally plausible. And that's the difference between philosophy and psychology or sociology. Mm-hmm. And that's it's a difference that a lot of people don't, it doesn't sit right in their head because it seems so detached. It mm-hmm. can seem so detached. I think it's still valuable because if you're going to say words like that's a bad thing to do, it's important that we have an idea of what they mean. And it's too often that a person doesn't know what they mean. They, if pressed, just mean that's behavior they don't like. Mm-hmm. And because someone else doesn't like a behavior, why should I care, right?
Exactly.
So it doesn't provide me with much of a reason to not care. But if you can build an argument as to why it's a bad idea, arguments have some objectivity to them. So if you can, if you're going to convince anybody, you need some sort of argument. And that's what moral philosophy, I think, does. Mm-hmm. Provide you with a way of arguing for why something is bad.
And that makes sense. And yeah. that it is valuable in that way. I just sometimes, if there's no application real time,
right.
I find it to be thought for thought's sake is fantastic in some ways. And then other times, it's just frustrating.
Yeah.
You know?
I agree. Well, let's cover the main objection then. So let's get back to where we were supposed to begin. And this is that social contract, fundamentally as a moral theory, creates morality from mutual agreement. So morality is not real in any metaphysical sense. It's real only in that people agree to behave this way. And you can agree without expressly saying you agree, but if you're a thoughtful person that recognizes that there is a system of rules and recognizes that you need to control your behavior based on the consideration of others, then you're in the ballpark of social contract. And the analogy that we gave, I still love, is it makes morality, moral statements as real as like money is real. Money is not, you know, the physical pieces of paper, the ink. It's the idea of the money that makes it real. And it gets even weirder, you know, when you think about it not even being based on paper. It's just a number in an account, right?
Yeah.
That's just, you know, there's nothing special about that number when you pull up your bank account online. That number is just a computer program that says that number. And so it really is just an idea. Mm-hmm. And morality is the same thing. It's an idea that is created, and therefore, since we're all working with it, then it has weight.
This is something that bothers people, just saying that.
Yeah.
Because a lot of things I hear, Christians, for example.
Oh, yeah.
They want to say, well, on what authority do you say something is bad? They're saying, like, God tells me it's bad.
Right.
But what authority do you say it's bad? We're saying...
Same authority that money has.
Right. Like, we made it up.
Yeah.
To quote George Carlin, we made the whole fucking thing up.
Sure. Well, absolutely.
That's the reason I think that ethics is really practical and applicable personally, because even if most people don't have a coherent ethical theory that they ascribe to,
right.
Once you've convinced yourself of a particular mode of thought within ethics, it's still going to influence the way that you think about the situations.
Yeah.
Once you've reasoned your way to being obligated to act a certain way, you don't want to act the other way. You feel
yeah.
morally obligated.
Yeah.
So the fact that everyone else is not thought about it and is kind of talking out of their ass
yeah.
does not necessarily remove moral culpability from them
right.
or from oneself.
The way I like to put it is it gives you more moral confidence. Because once you settle on a moral theory, you start to see that certain things that people think are immoral are not.
It's liberating.
And so when you engage in those things, you don't care anymore.
Oh, like you just but consider them non-issues.
Right. They're not an issue. And other people need to rise above. But other things that you know are wrong, you have a much, like you said, you have a much greater incentive to not do them because there's no ambiguity
right.
in your head. So, yeah, it does have that advantage. And so, you know, we could talk about advantages, but I think the previous episode already did that.
Mm-hmm.
The big problem with this is that since morality is created by beings who have some, at least some rudimentary conception of controlling their behavior in considering the interest of others. Any being that can't do that, by definition, morality doesn't apply to them.
Right.
Outside of the moral sphere.
Right. And so the kind of problem, the initial problem would be animals. Animals, it does not seem that they have the ability to control their behavior based on some sort of system of rules that allows them to consider the interests of other beings. And because it seems that animals, you know, for the most part, simply operate on stimuli and response. And that's why we view them this way. We don't hold animals morally accountable. There's a reason for that, you know. We might think that it's a terrible thing if someone's dog, for example, bites someone or, you know, injures them severely. But you'll hear over and over again that, well, don't blame the dog.
Blame the owner.
Blame the owner. Mm-hmm. The owner is the person who's in control there. They're the mind. They're the manager, yeah.
Dogs don't bite people. Their owners make them bite.
Right. So therefore, no dog should ever be banned. That's interesting, yeah.
Hmm.
I also wonder how this would be applied to people with that lack impulse control, that have mental disabilities.
Add them to the list.
So
that's notoriously a problem.
Now we can do whatever we want to them, too. That's cool.
And that's...
that's science.
That's so
awesome.
Just as unsettling.
Yeah. Right. Also, there's this problem with infants.
Yeah, children, and
that doesn't make me feel.
What
bad
about elderly with dementia?
You're fine with that.
Fuck babies. Oh, does anybody really want them in the moral sphere?
No, just not really.
Oh my god!
I think if you shit yourself, no one listens.
Exactly.
Hey, you know, we're all going to get old one day.
Exactly. Then you won't be able to.
We might lack sphincter control.
Therefore, you're not covered.
The moment I poop my pants,
I'm going to circle back to that whenever we talk about future people who don't exist. But
should I be worried about my future butthole?
Yes,
is it within
Shomer.
The moral sphere?
That's a moral sphere. Anyway, we're gonna stop.
It's just it's jokes.
Well, you know, this is probably why people. Oh God.
Go ahead.
Well, that's the tendency people have to like anthropomorphize animals and everything.
Right.
I think that's probably why they do that because. They always want to like give like human emotions to dogs,
sure,
and anything to kind of, I don't know, is it just something the human brain wants to do to help us relate to other things like that? I mean, people are always kind of, you know,
right,
talking about the dogs like, oh, he doesn't like that, or you know, just,
right. I mean, depends on your definition of the word like. I think you can say like with respect to animals and that not interfere on this, because liking is just, you know, having a pleasure center and a pain center, and you know, any animal, whether they are self-conscious or not, is going to move toward behaviors that they get rewards from. So I think that's fine. The issue here is not, and again, this is the difference between utilitarianism and social contract, right? The difference is not about can a being suffer or feel pleasure. The difference is about do they have deliberate control over their actions. Can they follow a system? And that's where, you know, a dog, well, see,
how do we
a dog
measure
can,
it?
A dog can follow a system.
Yeah.
They've been bred to work with humans, and so over thousands of years, they have been bred to basically obey rules that humans give them. So in a way, they're almost like extensions of the human who is training them, and that's why we blame the owner of the dog for the dog's behavior, etc. They're the one who is responsible, and the dogs are bred to be trainable. And ones that can't, we generally don't want to keep around. Because, again, those are like... some people would be offended by speaking this way, but the dogs are almost like tools. If you have a tool that you can't control, if I have a really powerful drill, and this is a really bad brand... that whenever I run it, it just runs on its own, and I can't control it, doesn't want to turn off. I've actually had a drill that did that. I had to throw it away because you can't – it's not safe.
Right.
Same thing with say, if there were a dog breed that was not controllable, not trainable, it would be the same kind of thing.
Or just any kind of animal that you want to keep as a pet that you can't domesticate.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, like that's why people generally don't try and keep pet lions. Because results may vary.
Some people
Siegfried
do.
Siegfried and Roy comes to mind.
Right. The results vary.
Yes, results do vary. I like that very much.
I just wonder how do they measure reasoning ability? What comes into the, all right, so this guy,
That's a really good question.
How do we decide?
There are ways, I mean, cognitive scientists have ways to do this. I'm not super familiar with this. I know that one way, it has to do with their ability to learn language. Mm-hmm. And this long experiment.
Well, then bees have language.
Sort of.
They don't have
the wiggle.
Depends on your definition of language.
Exactly.
Too. It needs to be lexical, as in develop symbols.
Okay.
There was this long-term experiment with Coco, the chimpanzee that learned sign language, mm-hmm. and they thought formed new sentences, but. The general agreement, in fact, almost overwhelming agreement, mm-hmm. was that the chimp did not actually learn the language. It was moving in ways of getting responses and things like that. Mm-hmm. It was just an elaborate system of training the chimp to get things that it
wanted. Well, the chimp thought it was training us to give it bananas.
Right.
It was,
And it succeeded. Yeah.
And it makes sense to me. I don't really see how you could have a social contract without language. Even if you had all of the rational content and you were sentient and aware and capable of imagining others' needs, how would you ever communicate in order to arrange that behavior?
Yeah, I'm not sure morality makes sense without language.
Well, me neither. Well, I think that, again, morality, I think, is an emergent quality from living with people, right? It's an emergent necessity, we talked about before in other episodes or something like that. I mean, if you live with other people, you have to have a way of communicating with them. I mean, would you say that language is also an emergent quality of people, of like, you know, something with a brain like ours?
I think that there are automatic emergent properties, and then there are synthesized emergent properties. Automatic ones are ones that just truly emerge in the sense of the word, as in they just come out from a situation. And I think language is 100% automatic emergent from human behavior.
I think so too.
I do not think morality necessarily is, and I don't think money necessarily is. I can imagine people living without morality. And I can imagine people living without money. I can't imagine...
They're called dirty hippies, Norm.
Yeah. I can't imagine people living without language. To me, they're not really human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I agree
totally.
Yeah. So, but I don't know. That might be debatable. But look, let's talk, you know, there's a lot of different directions that you could go with talking about this kind of stuff. I don't think anybody here would be super thrilled with having a conversation that dwelled on what other writers, other philosophers have written, and debating what they wrote in response to what other philosophers wrote about what they wrote. Okay, so we'll not do that. Let's just have a discussion about where we're drawing the line and how this results in rules. So I'm going to go ahead and say that I'm going to bite the bullet and say that animals and newborn infants and human beings that are mentally incapacitated are not in the moral sphere. I'm going to go ahead and say it. And I don't think that this results in anything really that bad happening.
I don't either. That's one of the other reasons I'm a little comfortable with biting the bullet, is that I don't think leaving them out of the moral sphere is necessarily... dangerous to them. I don't think it'll violate or bring them harm necessarily, if that makes sense.
And now, is this because I'm someone who uses the idea of indirect moral consideration. So that would mean that from a direct standpoint, I also would agree.
Okay.
That, like, directly speaking, they are outside of the moral sphere. But I just tell people there's kind of a silver lining way to... There's a grandfather clause we'll talk about.
I'm going to talk to Brittany now.
Mm. Okay.
Since she's the one who is least likely on board.
Yes, I am not on board.
Good. And so I want to be clear, just for the sake of clarity, a mother gives birth. The moment she gives birth, okay?
It's that easy. Come on.
Yeah. That's generally how it happens.
Like that. I think it would be more like splish.
Well, that's the doctor generally. Slapping the ass.
Kerplop. Okay, so that you got a newborn infant there. Mm-hmm. Let's say it's wiped off.
Hopefully.
I don't think it makes any sense for me to say I have a moral obligation to that person.
Okay, so then how do you view child rearing?
Okay.
Do you not feel that there's any sort of moral obligation to feed and clothe that child then?
Okay, now you... So these are bringing two different things. Mm-hmm. I'm fine with that. Let's talk about them in turn.
Okay.
Child rearing. Mm. So the parent having an obligation to raise their children well. I think they do have an obligation to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it is initially not an obligation to the infant.
More to society?
It's an obligation to society.
Okay.
Because there are a few things that you can do in life to society than create a new member. I mean, I can think of a few things that you could do that have a bigger impact, but most of us don't have that big of an impact on society unless we're going to do something terrible.
Yeah.
And so as far as in the normal range of things that we would do, creating a new citizen mm-hmm. is probably the most significant impact we have on our society.
Okay.
So I think the obligation parents have to society is huge. And therefore, I actually think that many parents, way too many, fail at this.
Oh, yeah.
Right,
I agree.
Here, we could talk about what that, just by saying that, that indirectly is going to affect that child's well-being.
That's right.
This is where the idea of indirect moral consideration comes mm-hmm. into
right.
the picture. I mean, it's where that child in and of itself doesn't have moral consideration given to it.
Right.
But the other behavior that you're saying these parents are obligated to do, it creates the same effect like
yeah.
of that.
Like, exactly.
Like the goal of morality or the goal of someone who wants to treat that child well mm-hmm. and wants that child to be cared for, your goal is that the child is treated well and cared for.
Right.
This gets you to the same place.
How does that factor in abuse? Child, you know, what?
Well, again,
is that a moral
I figure
thing?
That's part of how you're raising the child.
Sure. Yeah. Okay, so I want to talk about this. And you know, I just want to add a disclaimer.
Yeah, because
the disclaimer, Norm does like to beat and kill children.
Right.
Let's get them putting it out there on Front Street.
I heard that.
No,
I saw that on Facebook.
Hey, no, Jesus.
Now watch, I'm going to get fired from this school because
oh,
we heard
no.
that you beat children.
Oh, yeah. Oops.
No, anyway.
I don't beat them.
I want to add a disclaimer. My disclaimer is very important. This is a philosophical discussion, so we are going to say things that outside of a philosophical discussion would be ridiculously offensive.
Hmm.
We are doing this for the sake of trying to understand these things better, and so we don't like try to avoid stepping on toes. We're just going to talk plainly about this. So yes, in talking about all this stuff, things are going to sound weird. It sounds terribly weird, in fact, almost vile, to say that a parent doesn't have an obligation to their infant, has no mm-hmm. moral obligation to their infant. I understand someone listening to this thinking that, okay, these guys completely jump the shark. And, you know, the philosophy of social contract, this is ridiculous. This is academic bullshit. And I'm not going to tolerate any of this. I understand that. But here's the problem. All I'm saying is that it doesn't make sense to say that a parent has an obligation to a newborn infant. Because in doing that, they are treating the infant like they are a genuine person, and they're not yet.
Mm-hmm.
Every human is born premature. That means that we're a weird species. When we are physically separated from our mothers, we are nowhere near being developed yet. Not even close.
Parts of the brain are still developing.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Our bones are fusing over a long process. There's all kinds of things that are happening. All those kinds of things, all the kinds of things that generally happen in gestation and in other animals are still happening for us for years.
Go home, natural selection. You're drunk.
Yeah.
Seriously.
We're not fully developed until 25.
Really?
Mm-hmm, your bones don't completely seal off and stop
plus
growing. Oh, yeah, average 25, 23 to 28. 25 is the average age.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Huh. So technically.
What I think, I think an interesting point for listeners who maybe haven't followed us through the whole ethics series is that we've come across a lot of these issues in previous ethical theories.
Right.
And what we've found is that social contract, even though it fails to address some of these issues, it doesn't seem to fail nearly as hard as some of the other ones. Like I would say utilitarianism, even though people often talk about it as though it solves the animal rights issue, I think that utilitarianism dissolves into something so incoherent that it doesn't solve anything.
Right. Yeah.
And so I feel like I'm accepting social contract because it's as far as we got.
Right.
Everything else so far didn't make sense.
Makes sense.
If that's so, if you haven't listened to the previous episodes, the assumption that social contract is failing where other ethical theories have not, I don't think is correct.
That's a really great point.
Yeah. For me, part of the way I look at it is, I come back to, what is the purpose of morality or ethics? What is the enterprise we're trying to solve here? And even though, like, you know, to say, well, it's weird that you would have, that I would favor a moral system that seems to leave newborn infants out of direct moral consideration. But again, I'm looking at the overall purpose of morality. What we're trying to do is get benefits of living together.
Right.
If they have indirect moral consideration, it still works.
Right.
Now, I can understand how that might not sound satisfying, especially to people who want there to be an absolute right and wrong, and they want there to be real answers. To say this is indirect,
yeah,
it might. I can see why that sounds unsatisfying, but to me, it doesn't. Because for me, if I look at it from a functional perspective, the machinery is working, and we're still providing the coverage to people, even if indirectly, they still get the benefit.
You'd make a good insurance salesman. So the point that you made, Chalmer, super important. We're looking at the kind of the boundaries, the edges of morality, mm-hmm. right? And so, of course, things, when you're looking at the edges of a theory, things are going to get weird. You know, you look at extremes, like extremes with the theory of gravity. If you're looking at black holes, things get weird. If you're looking at particles that have almost no mass, their behavior gets weird. So that's kind of what we're doing now. We're looking at the very fringes, and so things are going to be weird. But the second point I wanted to make is, I think what makes people nervous is they think, okay, infants are not technically part of morality. Therefore, moral obligations to them are indirect. They're obligations to society or to parents or whatever. Doesn't that mean that our moral obligations to infants are going to be inherently weaker than our moral obligations to other human beings? And my problem with that is that's oversimplifying.
I think so too.
Because technically, my obligations to you are right in the wheelhouse of contract, of social contract. But there's a big difference between you and an infant. You can defend yourself.
Right.
So I don't have to look out for your interest all that much.
Mm.
Whereas an infant, even though they are not members of the social contract, because I have an obligation to society, now my obligations to infants are more.
Yeah,
because they have no means of defending themselves.
Right.
They have no means of providing a counterbalance that I can legitimately say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know that would offend you, or I didn't know I heard whatever. No. Yeah. So I have to err on the side of caution.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it actually results in the very high moral obligation that we already think we have.
Yeah. Well, this is why, you know, I've never myself thought of indirect as somehow being a lesser.
Right. Thing.
It's just a
You can understand why people would think
that. I can see how people could think that, but to me it's a different way of getting to the same spot.
Right.
Well, in that same way, to say that we're excluding anything from the moral sphere, I think people find that emotively uncomfortable because of the way that they think about morality.
Sure.
If we talk about morality as an emergent synthetic property of human interaction, it's inherent that they can't be part of the moral sphere, but that doesn't mean, well, then fuck them all. Just go on hunting sprees. It's
right.
There are still being outside the moral sphere does not necessarily conflict with the moral emotive ideologies of people who might object to it.
Right.
Like they think it would.
I will go ahead and get controversial though, because my position on social contract does result in actual policies that I think are not correct. And I'll give you an example. And again, I want to add, you know, a reference to this caveat of this is a philosophical discussion so that people don't get offended.
Please send your hate mail to Norman Schultz.
I am, because of being a contractarian, I am not categorically against infanticide. So, for example, if a couple gives birth to a child who is deformed, and let's say that on top of deformed, let's just make an easy example. On top of being physically deformed, they're mentally deformed. They're not going to have a pleasant life. They're going to have a life with almost no chance of getting the value out of life that any of us would have, cognitively or physically, because they have problems in both. I think right now we live in a time where it would be completely unacceptable for anybody to entertain the idea of terminating that that basically that's up to me an extension of pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And having them start over again and try to have a child who was healthier. I think nobody would consider that. They would consider that horrible. And if I were to ask them why it's horrible, they would not be able to tell me. They would actually get angry at me for asking them why it's horrible and expect me to just know that it's horrible.
I feel like a lot of people do think that, mm-hmm. and it comes from the shame that they're not supposed to think that, that they get angry.
That's right.
I think it also just comes from empathy. Mm-hmm. We still see that.
Misplaced empathy, yeah. I think.
Yeah. Or the potential that child could possibly, maybe, develop.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Unrealistic expectations.
A lot of them.
Yeah.
I think that even denial. A utilitarian person could reach that same conclusion that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you're just doing the calculus.
Right. But
they
what's weird.
Reach it easier.
I think they could do it much easier.
What's weird is that.
Population control.
Is that for a utilitarian, you're ending their life for them. Mm-hmm. For the contractarian, you're ending their life not just for who they might end up being, because actually, again, we don't have any moral obligations to future beings. You're ending their life because you don't want that situation. It's a general, it's almost an impersonal decision.
It's better for society as well if you want to take it back to that.
Right.
If you have an obligation to society, that child would just become a burden for X years on the society, and there would be no positive input.
And we have problems with that. Mm-hmm. We have people who are homeless. We have people in long-term care who are exactly in that situation where they don't have a very good life at all. They don't have any means of even necessarily understanding that they don't have a good life. But we are maintaining them, and people are spending emotional energy and on them, and nobody had to. So people think about this kind of solution to this problem, and it's considered extremely taboo. I like social contract in that it says it's not good for this to be taboo. This is actually a real consideration. So to me, that's a strength of social contract. It's a bad situation for everybody, and this is something that solves that situation. And it's kind of a shame that we have this kind of almost mythical or spiritual thinking to where we can't even consider that.
It's just human arrogance, in my opinion. We value ourselves so highly that even the most deformed and useless of ourselves.
Yeah. We
is
think it's
irreplaceable.
Right.
And that's I see that as human arrogance.
People cite the slippery slope argument on this, that if we decide that a newborn who is mentally handicapped severely and physically handicapped, well, then it's morally okay to end their life, then, well, where do you draw the line? What if parents give birth to a baby who's blonde and they wanted a brunette? Or they give birth to a female and they wanted a male. And now the contractarian is in a bit of a pickle.
I feel like it just got ridiculous at that point.
Well.
And that's my problem with social contract. People are unreasonable.
Now we are right in the thick of what each of us three who favor this moral theory are going to have a hard time explaining. Why is it wrong for a parent who gives birth to a girl who would rather have a boy, or a blonde and would rather have a brunette? Why is it wrong for them to end the life of their baby?
Well, I kind of look at it from a starting point of certain things that you are tacitly agreeing to whenever you engage in any kind of action,
uh-huh.
including whenever you engage. Like, there's certain unknowns that you have to be able to accept when you do anything.
Uh-huh.
And I think that if you...
Having a baby is like playing roulette.
A little bit.
Yeah, it's got the whole knob and everything.
Well, I mean, a little bit. Yeah.
Sorry.
You know, we circumcise the knob sometimes, but...
I don't know what this is, though.
That's the roulette. That's...
That's the slot machine.
My bad.
Norm doesn't gamble enough.
No, apparently not.
Vegas, let's go.
Familiar with knobs, though.
When a joke goes wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, there's certain things I think it seems like you're rationally aware that certain outcomes are, there are certain unknowns, and that if you're going to engage in an activity anyways, you've got to be, you're tacitly accepting those outcomes to me.
This reminds me of Gattaca.
I don't think this gets us out of the problem. Because
I look at it more from a societal thing, where we're talking about you want people to be If you're going to choose to, if you're going to choose to voluntarily say we're going to bring a child into the world, I think you're saying to society we're going to also do the child rearing thing.
Okay.
And I think that,
why can't they just start over?
I don't know. I kind of feel like society says, look, if you choose to do that, you got to carry it all the way through.
That's not an answer.
But then that could be applied to the deformed child too. You That's played not an roulette. Answer. You lost. You made the commitment. Now raise the.
You're just saying child. Society says this. You're devolving into a cultural relativist.
Hmm. Where do you go with it?
I don't know. Hmm. I think I'm stuck with the position that it's okay for the parents to have a do-over.
I don't know if it really bothers me that much. I can see where it becomes an issue if what you choose as a preference inflicts something negative on society down the road.
Right. With the whole gender thing.
Right.
Yeah. Now that seems reasonable.
But
we don't want to have a world that is a bunch of men.
Right. It's not.
That is a bad thing. And China's going to have a real big problem with that.
Yeah. I think we can. I think we can hold each other to the moral expectation that we don't breed ourselves towards one gender.
Sure.
It's silly.
Sure.
But outside of that, I mean, you think about things like genetic engineering.
You're a transhumanist.
A little bit, yeah.
Me too.
And so I kind of don't see a problem with it.
Me neither.
Yeah, if I guess it's, I have to go that way too.
If the if the preference that they want is either neutral or beneficial or just preferential without inflicting some harm in society,
yeah.
And I don't afford babies any moral consideration. I don't even afford them the notion of sentience. So it's right. Hard for me to feel morally obligated in any way.
Courageous.
Regarding that.
I'm going to talk to Brittany right now.
All right.
So where we have come to is that as a society, it would be totally okay for parents to terminate the life of their newborn infant because that infant had some fairly trivial feature that they did not like.
Brown hair instead of
brown hair.
Blonde hair.
I think the trivial, I cannot say I don't agree with you on physical and mental deformity. I completely agree with you on that one. I feel that ending an infant's life based on brown hair rather than blonde hair, I think that's wasteful. I think it's...
That's a good point.
It's just, why go through the 9 months?
There's a lot of energy that was expended.
Mm-hmm. So if you have
nothing.
Two people with brown eyes shooting for a blue-eyed boy, at some point you got to just tell them, cut it out.
Yeah.
You're idiots.
Stop right. it. Stop it. I mean, what are you going to do with all
it's
those
still
bodies
possible,
at that
by the
point?
Way.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Should we say, does it matter at all about the kind of people who...
Okay, let's talk about
that,
character. Talk about character.
That's where I was going to go, but I don't know if that works either.
No, I don't know if it does either, but let's try to travel that road. But, so let's just make sure that we're all up to the same point. Character considerations, the way they affect morality is that a particular act might not, because of the circumstances in itself, be morally wrong. But because the motivations that are involved in engaging in that activity are motivations that in other areas are wrong, then we might not want to encourage that behavior.
I look at people who like do things like torture animals.
Yes.
Like this.
Mm-hmm. This is a perfect example. So I don't have an obligation. Human beings don't have moral obligations to squirrels.
Right.
That makes no sense. But... I have a legitimate moral complaint about a human being who catches squirrels, brings them into their home, and tortures them.
What's the difference between torture and killing for food, then? Is it just a practicality thing?
Well, killing for food, let me get to that.
Okay.
Okay? So someone who tortures squirrels, because that comes from a place that is known to be a correlate with other kinds of antisocial behavior, severely antisocial behavior, it's basically a sign of a sociopath.
Did Jeffrey Dahmer torture squirrels?
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Yes. And I think that it's something like more than half of the caught serial killers at some point in their childhood to, you know, 20s ended up doing some sort of torture with animals.
Yeah.
So it's a known sign. So, you know, parents, if you have a child who, you know, gravitates toward torturing or animals, then you know I might need to take my
You might want to check
therapist.
The fridge for a head, is all we're saying.
Yeah. So because of that, this is a way of condemning that behavior. That we want alarms to go off when somebody does this. And so it's, you know, if I want someone arrested for torturing squirrels, it's not because I'm feeling bad for the squirrels. I am, but I just don't think that that's necessarily part of the moral sphere. But it's not for the sake of the squirrels. It's for the sake of the impact of allowing this kind of behavior on society.
You feel more afraid of that person.
Right.
What if that person lacks impulse control? And because outside the moral thing.
Then they're not going to make a very good citizen.
Look, Chomber is kind of a squirrely guy. It's not going to be that big of a leap for that person to begin torturing him.
Yeah.
Someone's like, he's like, I set a Bunsen burner out. I caught Chomber. That's how you lure a scientist.
Yeah.
Little box Chomber propped up with a thing. And Chomber's like, oh, my God, I'm Bunsen.
Run in the room.
He pulled the string and Chomber got stuck.
It happens all the time. Happened to me last Tuesday.
Yeah. I can kind of see how if you have a moral obligation to society or a moral obligation indirectly to an infant, if you select their life or death on the basis of an arbitrary standard that disregards their future rational autonomy relative to the society that they're in.
Yeah, no, you're not going to get away with that.
You don't think so?
No, because you can't attribute a property that a being is going to eventually have is now giving them the rights of having that.
No, but Norm, you said something that resonated with me a moment ago. When you're talking about torturing animals, you're saying the kind of alarm bells that sets off in your head. Now, you said it might not be necessarily immoral what you're doing to the squirrel, but it's still setting off some alarms.
This is why I'm okay with animal testing.
Those same alarms get set off in my head when we're talking about someone terminating a child because they have blonde hair instead of brown.
Why?
Sociopathic a little bit.
I think that might be a little bit sociopathic.
Not technically.
Why would that be sociopathic? That's not torturing anyone. It's not harming.
It's killing for no real reason.
It would be psychologically sociopathic because people tend to consider and feel as though infants are other people. But it wouldn't be literally sociopathic in the sense that you can't empathize with them because in actuality you can't empathize with them. Does that make sense?
No. And you know it doesn't. No, because what you're saying is that we should take seriously something that we know is an error.
Right. I'm not saying we should. I'm just deriving it. So sociopath, in a psychological sense, means a failure to feel empathy. It doesn't mean a failure to feel empathy for beings in the moral sphere, if that makes sense. So a person.
So if I fail to see, to empathize with a statue that you have of a figure who is, they look like, by their body language, they're in pain. If I look at that and I don't have an emotional reaction, then there's something wrong with me?
If you're a sociopath, you will fail to have a reaction in most situations. So being a sociopath doesn't mean a failure to empathize in a single particular context. It means a neurological inability to feel that empathetic response regardless of situation.
Yeah, see, the big problem with where you're going with this
semantically, we're talking about it in two different senses.
No, I understand what you're saying, but I don't think you understand the impact of this. This would turn the social contract person into a utilitarian. Because now they have to take into consideration suffering because that elicits an emotional response. And then it applies to animals and all that stuff. And
But suffering is the burden, isn't it?
Huh?
If you're trying to act in a way that relieves the burden from another person.
I agree with you.
You guys are utilitarians right now.
I'm not promoting it the sense that, I'm not making an argument.
I thought you were.
No.
Well, how does a utilitarian
sounded like an argument. I heard a conclusion and some premises.
Yeah, but how does a utilitarian get out of this?
It's so awesome.
Though? Huh? How do a utilitarian get out of this? You could kill a newborn infant child in a completely painless way where there would be no suffering.
No. Because any being who can feel pain or suffer implicitly has preferences.
Even a newborn baby.
That's right. It has preferences. And
its preference is not to suffer pain.
Right. But then when you take it into account, its preferences, it would also prefer not to be killed.
How do you know that?
You're not going to get anywhere questioning that.
If
you're going to go into the mind of a squirrel, I'm pretty sure that you're going to find that the squirrel would prefer to not be killed. It would not make any sense for an animal to prefer its own demise.
So reason doesn't factor in at all then?
No. Just the ability to have preferences. Being able to reason about preferences, utilitarians have written extensively on this. The ability to reason on preferences is not the same thing as having them. You can have preferences. Reasoning on them is a very different procedure. So that's how they get out of that.
Their answer doesn't seem very satisfactory to me, though.
Well, because I think the fundamental, you know, at the atom of their theory, it doesn't make any sense to me. Because why do I care about suffering objectively? I only care about suffering that I feel, and I might feel some when I see being in suffering. But I, in the abstract, suffering is just a part of the function of life on the planet. It doesn't mean anything to me. It's only given meaning if you're able to rationalize it. The utilitarian doesn't go that route. So to me, the difference between, you know, if I punch you in the arm really hard, well, you might not even feel it. Let's say I punch Chalmer in the arm really hard. He's got a little more bone right there on the surface. He might feel it right away. That's very different than if I punched an animal, because it has a bunch of meaning for you.
Right.
Right? The animal is just a sensation. And so that's, to me, the difference.
I want to come back to then the idea of getting rid of a child that has like a different color, whatever,
right,
than what you like. Do we not like it? I mean, is this the same reason we reject the idea of eugenics?
Did we reject it? I don't think I did.
So do you not have a problem with it in general? I mean, I think people have. I think it makes people uneasy. I mean, it seems like you're promoting. I don't know. Like, is that person? Would that person be promoting the idea that certain races or colors of skin or eye color or hair color are better, or
well,
just that they like them better?
Okay, but you know that those are two different things. If you're engaging in eugenics because you think, say, Aryans are better, more valuable than other races, well, now we have a problem.
But you, is that not like? But someone could just want blonde hair instead of brown,
sure,
but not for that reason.
Sure, they just will like blonde hair. I mean, that's why a parent has a child to begin with. They just want to have a child. Why not let them have the child they want? I don't care. So this is why I just bite the bullet on this one.
And I suppose I have to too, because I think, because I also have no problem with the idea of manipulating the genome to make the child have blonde.
Yeah,
like that wouldn't bother me at all.
I was gonna. That's the direction I was gonna go next. So you're predicting that. So that's good. Yeah. And I like the way you put it, Chalmer, that as long as these decisions don't have a negative impact, say in the aggregate for, you know, society, like as in choosing genders would.
Yeah.
And probably you could make a case for choosing races that might have a negative impact on society.
It would
as well.
Make, personally, I just think that genetically it would make us too homogenous.
Yeah.
I think
so
that
would be
the
more
issue.
Vulnerable. There's advantage in having a mix. I think that's probably true.
And I think if actually applying eugenics in a way that's responsible and useful is a lot easier than it sounds, or a lot harder than it sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
The actual global impact of widespread eugenics would be really hard to predict and understand.
But I can think of ways that you could definitely support doing it, and it really would make society better.
I do agree.
So, for example, selecting for children that had just better brain function.
Mm-hmm.
Selecting for children who had, less chances of the, genetic diseases. I mean, why would society benefit from having babies that have congenital diseases? That makes no sense.
Yeah, and I've always never had a problem with the idea of purposely manipulating estrogen.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I think it's just something that's...
All right.
I'll just, I don't know. I still hope people don't do that.
Really?
What I'm saying is I hope that people don't get rid of a child because they had brown hair instead of blonde, because it seems somewhat superficial.
And I think
just
Brittany,
dye the kids
I think
hair,
Brittany said
sakes.
The I think Brittany said the best argument against it. The difference between doing it before reproduction, as in manipulating the genome of the zygote, or what am I thinking?
Zygote.
Yeah, the zygotes.
Yeah.
At that point, I would actually call it a non-issue.
Right, it's totally a non-issue because there's no investment in anything then. But if a woman is going to, you know, go through the trouble of pregnancy for nine months and all of the issues, discomfort, and, you know, some risk involved in that, just to change it then and start over, that seems wasteful.
It's wasteful.
And that, I think, is one of
frivolous.
The better arguments for the difference between the two. Absolutely.
I can actually live with that.
Yeah. Well, crazy. I think we might be coming to some form of agreement. Shall we talk about the animal problem a little bit more?
Because I want to clarify.
Okay.
My point was that torturing an animal does not make you a sociopath. I was disagreeing with Nick and agreeing with you.
Torturing an animal does not make you a sociopath. Right. I agree.
They said it seems sociopathic.
It's the other way around. It's a symptom of being a sociopath.
That was my point.
But here's the way I like to think about this. There are ways that we are testing on animals now that is basically torturing them. Right? I mean, we give them open wounds and then put substances in their open wounds. We make them ingest things that make them very uncomfortable. We spray things in their eyes.
We grew an ear on the back of a mouse or a rat.
Yes. So,
make pigs glow in the dark.
Sure. We do all kinds of, I think it's safe to say, fucked up shit.
The scientist's defense, those pigs were adorable.
Yeah. And they glow.
And bacon awesome. That glows? Are you kidding me?
You can find them. So, look.
It's always a problem. I can never find my goddamn bacon in the dark.
that's why someone created this.
For you, Shomer. That's insane.
Turn the lights on. I have to see myself in the mirror.
So
from all the bacon.
Yep. Oh.
So, okay. Here's my thing and the way this works. If you are torturing an animal, but it is for some purpose, human beings don't do things without a purpose. You know, it's like the line in The Hunt for Red October, right? Russians don't take a dump without a plan. Human beings don't do things for no purpose. We don't do things for no reason. We do things for a reason. A sociopath might torture an animal for his own pleasure, also as a way of testing his boundaries. All those things are not a good thing for a person to have in the general being a citizen.
That's more about what I was going for. So sure. The word sociopath, I suppose. I don't know what that's called, but...
No, I think it's sociopath is okay. Pretty right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But someone who tortures an animal... But it's for the purpose of learning something that has medical or scientific value. That, to me, doesn't come from a place of character that is negative. In fact, I think that comes from a place that is generally positive, though could be abused. This is someone who is willing to do uncomfortable things for the sake of bettering the planet, mm-hmm. bettering the way we live, learning more. Those character traits are not... bad. Yeah. So for me, this is why the contractarian can justify experimentation on animals, something that we already do and something that is already very important to us. And now we have a intellectual means of saying why this is okay.
Yeah.
So I think this is actually a feature of the theory, not a problem.
Me too. I'm with you on that. And I have a question. Do you think that a utilitarian can't do math that makes that work?
I think they can.
Like if they just do a simple math thing of like, you know, we tortured these animals who have this degree of capacity for suffering, but we're going to help actual human beings with this capacity for their well-being is so much more.
Yeah.
Like can they do math to get out of that?
I think they can.
Just Peter Singer can't.
I think it goes in the paper. You remember when they were talking about one person suffering for 100 days versus a billion people suffering for 100 days?
Right. Minus one or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. I think with the animal testing, you're hurting a monkey, 20 monkeys, for 10 years, but you're benefiting 7.8 billion people for the rest of their lives.
Sure.
I think that's what it comes down to.
Sure.
As far as that's, and it's an ugly truth. I don't like saying that I'm all right with it.
But right. Closer to like 3 billion.
I think that...
my bad.
I think
my
that... You remember the Frey essay that we read?
Refresh, I don't know what it was about.
It's him talking about speciesism and the value of persons.
Oh, yeah.
Mm.
Where he differentiates between humans and animals in that humans are basically just vessels that contain more extremes of pleasure and suffering because of our ability to cognize. We have richer lives, and therefore animal lives are in morally considerable. They're just not as morally considerable as humans. And if I were a utilitarian, I think I would accept his view. I think later in other places, Singer more or less accepts this, though he warns of there being some problems. But I think that Frey's view is fine, and this does allow for some animal testing. But the problem from the utilitarian standpoint is that the line between animals and humans is blurred.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really there. And so what Frey points out is that if you're okay with testing on animals because of the benefit to humans, then you also might recognize a situation where it's perfectly legitimate to test on humans for the sake of other humans. And it also very well might be that the calculation works out that it's permissible to test on humans for the sake of animals.
This brings up something. This means that if people have a physically and mentally deformed child, they are obligated to keep it because we need research subjects.
Right. Test on the sociopath.
That was a horrible thing to say.
Yes, it was.
You but are a terrible person.
Contractarians don't have this problem because there is a line between persons and non-persons. Yeah. So I can test on animals by using this utilitarian calculation. And by the way, I think I told you guys about this. My general thinking about what's right about utilitarianism is I think contractarianism is the best way to characterize the moral rules. Once the moral rule is satisfied, to just get a better outcome, I think you become a utilitarian. So I don't think that morality is best thought of in terms of utilitarianism. But once you already know the right and wrong, then you can use utilitarianism to further clarify the things you shouldn't be doing.
Well, this is why I've always thought that social contract works as a great foundation, and you can add to it.
Sure.
Because you can take parts of virtue ethics if you want to, as far as talking about what kind of people you want in society.
I'm not morally obligated to make sure you're happy. No. But if I want to, what's the best way to think? Well, now I should think like a utilitarian.
Yeah. Mm. I think I was looking at it more from like, you know, what is a virtuous citizen of that society?
Sure.
You don't have to do that.
Sure.
But you could talk about it, and there are ways to do that.
It does, in one sense, make the world a better place. Yeah. So absolutely.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. You meet the needs of your self-interests in that moral context, uh-huh. and then you worry about extracurricular desire in terms of morality. It's interesting.
Now, is this why some people say that, you know, like social contract is really just utilitarianism? And like,
some people say that.
I feel like it's not, though, because of the starting point.
No.
I'd say it's much more individualistic than...
It is.
I'd say they're antithetical.
But that's important. Mm-hmm.
Spots.
It is. And I think that we've covered places where the two decision processes diverge just in this conversation. So I think that is not really right. Mm-hmm. I think the general argument is that social contract is justified on utilitarian grounds. That it's the best way to live. And ultimately, what we mean by best is it makes everybody happier. Yeah. And that's, to me, where people live. And I disagree because I can imagine a world where the total happiness is higher than the contractarian world, but people's rights are violated. Maybe a small number of people are their rights are violated. And I don't want that world. I want a world where maybe we're not as happy as we could be in the total, but at least people's rights aren't violated. And therefore, you know, we have more control over our own destiny, even if we screw it up.
Right.
But I had a challenge to you guys. As contractarians, aren't we okay with doing scientific or medical testing on mentally handicapped humans?
I'm trying to think.
I have a little trouble with it because distinguishing between someone who is sufficiently mentally handicapped and insufficiently mentally handicapped to be excluded from the moral sphere seems fuzzy to me.
Oh, you're taking the epistemological detour.
Am I?
Yeah. So what you're saying is you're going to get out of this by saying we can't know whether they're really mentally handicapped. And that's not going to be scientifically very supportable because we understand enough about the brain now.
I think that we can know. But it's... With animals, I don't ever feel like there's any possibility that my moral duty there would be wrong because they're never going, I can't even mess up and then have them be a moral agent and me just be wrong about it.
Okay.
In the case of the mentally handicapped, even if we do understand it, there could still be situations where we are wrong. And that kind of, the middle ground kind of bothers me. I don't know.
What if you accidentally cure the mentally handicapped person and they're like, that really hurt after you did?
Okay, let's be clear. We're talking about a condition that is not curable.
True.
Okay.
No, I think
obviously, if the person is has a handicap that is curable, then obviously we wouldn't want to test on them because they would have the same standing as a healthy infant. Where this is a being that has value as a future citizen, and so it's not wise to treat those poorly, as well as it does not treat, since everybody goes through a transition of weakness, both when they're an infant and when they're asleep, We would not have a good society if we just said, okay, well, the moment you fall out of being in deliberate cooperation with everybody else, then we're going to get you. No, right. We don't want to have that.
So, are we talking about doing this testing on them to help them or to help others? Not going to help them.
Yes.
Yeah, either or to help wouldn't others. Be relevant.
No, if it's to help them, then there's a hope for a cure.
Yeah, but if it's to help them, then I'm okay with
that. I'm just not talking about that.
Because people do experimental treatments all the time.
Absolutely. I'm not talking about that.
Okay.
So
I would say don't object to it, but only with the caveat that by mentally handicapped, I mean outside the moral
sphere. Yes,
yeah.
Okay.
Not possibly in the moral sphere. So
yes.
Not the mentally handicapped as a general category, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So that's just the careful distinction.
This is a fuzzy area for me.
Yeah?
Because I'm uncomfortable with the idea of testing. And here's why. And it's not a great argument. But this is, to me, this is just absolutely right on the edge of morality. To me, the difference is they look human. And therefore, doctors who are going to be torturing them effectively, because if it were pleasant, then we wouldn't care, right? We're talking about unpleasant forms of testing on them for the benefit of others. So that's a form of torture.
Well, I was going to say
this. Hang on. If they're doing that, well, then this is going to be too similar to them possibly torturing a real human being, a human being that is more fully formed or more fully functioning, in which case I think that it would say things that are negative about that doctor's character, that they can do it and live with it.
I was going to bring it back to the character thing and the kind of people that you want in society. So, I mean, people who are able to do those sort of things.
Right.
I don't know if it's necessarily might harm their character. But I think it's detrimental. I mean, it's certainly going to have to desensitize them.
By the way, what's interesting about that argument is if you give that argument credence, then it actually applies to some animal testing.
Mm-hmm.
Because some animals, their reactions are so close, therefore our natural sympathetic reactions are harmed by that. And I do worry that we do too much animal testing and that it might be harming the people who are involved in that industry.
But that's generally why they try not to, like that. I mean, it's looked down upon to do certain types of animal testing on chimps,
right,
but not to rats.
Right.
And that kind of squares with that.
I think that
it?
Makes sense.
I think so too.
And I agree. Because you look at some of the, like, Nazi Germany and the human testing they did.
Yeah.
When you read about the stuff that they did to people, it says something about their character.
Yeah.
A lot.
I don't know that you could do some of those things in an academic interest without being severely affected.
Right.
People come back from war with PTSD. I don't think you can witness that kind of suffering and just sort of shrug it off.
This does bring up an interesting possibility, though. And people have written about weird scenarios, by the way, that fall off from contractarianism. Here's one. Okay. So what about building robots to test on
humans.
The mentally handicapped humans?
Well, because, Norm, one of the first robotic rules is that it cannot harm a human.
Right.
Or by its inactions or
but
actions.
But that rule doesn't make any sense. It should be person.
You saw iRobot too, huh?
It's written in the rules. I didn't make the rules.
This is an argument from authority.
Yeah.
From Isaac Asimov.
Argumentum via Asimov. So.
I don't know if I would want a race of robots sufficiently independent and capable of torturing people without feeling
easy. Oh, no.
That makes me feel uncomfortable.
No. They're
I feel
dependent.
Like this is the premise
have you
of
seen Terminator?
No. They're completely dependent.
Do you want Skynet doing this?
They have to
Arnold
be, independent. They have to be independent enough that I don't have to play any direct role in the actual torturing.
Not a problem.
I'm sorry,
but they're
Norm.
Completely dependent on us. As
danger
in, you know, they got all kinds of other safety features. You know, they require
no
high levels of power. No Skynet.
It starts like that, but then later on, you're deactivated.
I've almost gotten to Chalmer. I want to see what he thinks about this.
You think so, but then later, the robot, as you're turning off, is just going, Dreezy.
What I love about all these movies, as a side note, is that somehow they've solved a way from just unplugging them. I mean, I don't understand the problem here. It's not that hard to control power sources. So,
well, sometimes solar powered.
Yeah, but Norm, you have to crush a Terminator.
Then they're going to be terribly weak because the sun doesn't make
just
enough power.
Beat the shit out of them at night.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I really worry about this. By the way, this is going to become a problem in our lifetime.
Probably. Killing machine by day, paperweight by
not,
night.
Not a killing machine, but machines that are independent and we can't control. This is probably going to become a problem in our lifetime.
Mm. Well, we already have autonomous programs running things behind the scenes and on servers and that do all kinds of automated things for us, fly planes, scary things, things you don't want them to screw up.
Yeah.
And they have no moral obligation.
So, okay, I'm going to press you, Chalmer.
So I would say in theory that that would be morally acceptable.
He's biting the bullet.
However, it's we have to look at it in terms of gains and losses and its benefit to society too.
Right.
Research, you're always weighing expense and effort. How many different things can we torture people and solve that deserves an army of torturing robot?
Right, right.
That's an expensive operation. Regular research on mice is expensive, extremely expensive. So I would say I'm partly morally okay with it because I know it would almost never happen because doing it the other way is cheaper.
Yeah, as well as there's this possibility of creating human tissue from stem cells.
Yeah.
To where you can test things without there being any sentience there at all. And therefore, it's nowhere, it's not even in the sense torture at all.
You culture the relevant part of a person.
So, in a way, this would be more
printers.
Of a.
3D printers. You can print a heart now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, in a way, this would be more of a problem for contractarians if we didn't live in the kind of world that we live in.
Yeah.
Well,
exactly.
What about the idea of like the overall. This, I don't know how to phrase this. Like the psychological, the health of a society. Like, do you think if people knew that there were a whole bunch of torture robots torturing people, would that bother?
They're not
people.
By definition, severely handicapped.
I was picking it back in to what you were saying. They look like us.
Right.
Would that bother enough people that they might say that makes us uneasy enough that we don't want that?
I don't know. I
don't. I don't think that's a good argument. But like, I think it kind of.
I think it would.
Do you think it could dovetail at all to what you were saying before about the look like us?
You don't think it would bother people?
I don't, because how many of you have seen like a video?
I think it would.
How many of you have seen a video of like the way a beef farm works or how they?
But this is different though. I mean, cows don't look like us. I mean, do you think that? Didn't that would dovetail into the
argument against where you're going?
I've seen a pig slaughtered, and it was. It freaked me out. Like, it's very, very violent.
Right.
But I think.
By the way,
a lot
where
of people
did you
see
this? Did you see it in person or a video?
It was on video.
The problem I have with a lot of these videos is that what makes them popular is that they happen to be so botched.
True.
And therefore, you're seeing the worst of the worst.
Right.
I suspect that, you know, no farmer wants to have a. Animal
it's
have
the
a
extreme.
Violent death, right?
But many, many people see those, and many, many, many people still eat meat or are aware of those conditions and still eat meat.
But vegetarians are increasing in numbers.
True, but
I
still,
feel like, I
still
think
a minority.
People would be bothered. I think they would be bothered.
I think some people would be bothered.
I think a lot of people.
I think
it would be a split.
What I said
50,
kind of
50.
Dovetails what you're talking about.
You think it would be 50-50?
Mm-hmm. I think that I think half the population...
Yeah.
I think half the population, at least, I think would be one of those things.
We're all aware of genocides around the world, incredible acts of torture, buses full of women getting kidnapped and raped. And we go home and we watch movies and play video games and talk about dumb shit over dinner. So I really think that not so much ignorance, but distance is sort of bliss. We don't.
Well, we're talking about things that we can do something about. Right.
True.
And, you know, having robots engaged in medical research with the mentally handicapped is a pretty obscure thing that would have to be made with a lot of public consent and all kinds of stuff. So I think it probably wouldn't happen.
Right. I don't object to it morally, but...
And I don't think it's very useful, like you were saying.
I don't think I'll ever have to.
Yeah, I'll never have to do it. But I don't really like the direction that we're going, though, with what you're bringing up.
No.
I don't think social contract makes sense if you start giving moral consideration to anything simply because the majority of people want to give it moral consideration.
That's not what I'm saying. I was kind of coming back to, like, I'll just say for me personally, like, it would bother me if a scientist was doing it.
Right.
For the reason you were talking about, from like the look like us thing.
Mm-hmm.
It would also bother me if it was a robot doing the same thing for the same reason, I think.
Well, okay. Yeah, because someone would have to go to great troubles to invent that robot.
Right.
And so in a way, they would be torturing people just indirectly.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, I think we've resolved this in that there's not much benefit to be had from this. So this doesn't make sense.
So you could even argue that it would be immoral on the basis that it would be impractical and useless wasteful.
Right.
Yeah, but I mean, the closest I could get was going the fuzzy route that you went.
Right.
By saying it would just still make me uncomfortable because of the look-like factor.
Yeah.
But that's not actually real moral consideration, is it? up. So
I think that you can give some credibility to an emotional effect on a normal human being, and that emotional effect be based on quality traits that you really want to have in citizens. And I think you do want sympathy to be in our citizens.
I think so too.
And so I don't think that it, considering how long human beings have been eating meat, I don't think it says negative things of someone who is able to slaughter an animal. I think a vegetarian who argues that a person who slaughters an animal is something wrong with them, I think at that point they're being too partisan. So even though I give some strength to their arguments, I think that argument wouldn't work.
Yeah.
So I think that character traits do play a role, but I think you can definitely take it too far.
Yeah. Well, I mean, character traits, I mean, that's, I've always kind of considered it to be like a virtue ethics side of that you can, if you want, bring into the picture. And I've always thought that social contract works better if you, you know, social contract, I feel like, is what you use to build the house. But, you know, if you want to decorate it, use some virtue ethics.
You know? I gotcha. And, you know, it should be stated that kind of one of the big names in contractualism, Scanlon, in his book, he says that contractualism doesn't explain morality in its totality, that it only explains a certain part of morality. I think that's a cop-out, but I understand why he's saying this. Because of these other indirect concerns and things like that, he wants there to be room for another moral theory to even expand on this. And I can see there being ties, but I do think that it's still a cop-out. I think that contractualism does best explain our usages of the wording good and bad. But regardless, look, we could talk about more kind of on the finer points or on the edges of morality if we wanted to. An example of something that I saw brought up with contractualism is this modern problem of taking antibiotics when you have a somewhat trivial surgery, and this effect on society in general is going to make antibiotics useless. And so people have argued that if you're a contractualist, then it seems, by own logic, you have a moral obligation to avoid taking antibiotics.
Indeed.
And I think that those kind of borderline arguments are interesting, but I think that that brings up a problem that we have anyways. We have a real problem with this. So I think it's not surprising. It doesn't speak ill of the theory that it might lead to an immoral obligation that we might not recognize immediately. I don't think that speaks badly of the theory.
Me neither. Mm-mm. Do we want to, before we...
It's a logistical problem.
Yeah.
Should we talk about future people?
Well, we're going to have to keep it short because we're...
We could do it short. Yeah. I don't think it'll take too much time. I think this will be one where we'll probably just bite the bullet easily.
Yeah, the summary here is that in order for contractualism to work, there has to be a mutual obligation of control of behavior. That's why I don't have a moral obligation to an animal, because it wouldn't be returned. And morality is a system based on mutual agreement. Well, what about our obligations to future people, obligations to not ruin the earth? Well, that would be a one-way obligation, because I can do things to harm or benefit them, but they can't do anything to harm or benefit me.
Yeah.
And the way I resolve this problem is I double down and say the problem is actually worse than that. I can't harm future generations.
It's impossible.
It's not possible for me to
bastards.
Harm.
They don't exist.
Get away with everything.
Because they don't exist, and if I change my behavior, then I change who exists in the future. Well, therefore, those people are not better off than if I had not acted. They're different people. And we've kind of talked about this before.
Mm-hmm.
I've always said, Norm, like, my
did you catch that, by the way?
I did.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
When you think about it?
Yeah. I
it's timelines.
Yeah. It's very
Star Trekian.
Very, yeah, a Doctor Who.
Well, sure. Honestly, Norm, is like I tend to always say to people, like, what if I stole your van?
Right.
Well, you don't have a van. I can't steal it.
Right. That's a very
how can I possibly
poignant way.
So if someone says that to me, like, you know, what I was like, well, what if you steal my van? They're like, do you have a van? No.
Right. Right.
It's impossible for you to steal my
car. No, and you know, it gets even more absurd than that. If you go onto a car lot and you buy a car, well, you're taking that car off the market that somebody else could have enjoyed.
And that's wrong.
Did you harm them by buying that car then? Well, then you harm people all the time. I just had a ham sandwich. somebody else did couldn't eat that because I bought that ham. I mean, you know, this is ridiculous.
The entire thing about future generation stuff to me is a little bit weird. It doesn't, I feel like it's kind of just absurd to talk about it in some respects like that.
It is very weird because I think every one of us believes that it would be wrong to just ruin the planet.
Yeah, and here's something I
But it's hard to figure out why.
This is a little incomplete. I was just ruminating on this morning on the way over here. But whenever we talk about morality a lot of times, I never factor time into it a lot. Mm-hmm. Like we usually, a lot of times, we're always talking conceptually about hypothetical people that don't exist anyways. But we're talking about the machinery of this moral apparatus, the moral apparatus we've created or we're using. We're using social context, so we're saying, so for example, hypothetically, let's say we have people living in this place. We want our actions to be correct no matter what.
Right.
I feel like time shouldn't really factor in, does it? I mean, now, obviously it has to some degree.
No, place, I don't think that's right. Because I know what you're doing. You're saying that time and space are technically the same thing.
A little bit.
Yeah, but again, we've solved the bridge of space in that if someone lives in Bangladesh, because of the way, say the internet works or commerce works, I can harm them.
Yeah.
And they can harm me. And that's just not the case with our current connections with time.
Yeah. Well,
someone in the future cannot harm me.
No, that wasn't really more, I guess the way I was looking at it is whenever I try and make a decision I think is the right decision, I also want it to be the right decision tomorrow or 10 years from now. I want to be able to tell someone the set of circumstances and what my conclusion was,
that
and I want
solve
it to
this
be
either.
The right decision.
That doesn't solve this either, because when you say that you want it to be the right decision tomorrow or 10 years from now, you're talking about tomorrow again making that decision, or 10 years ago again making that decision, as in it's a new decision. You just want to be able to defend that decision at any time.
Yes.
The problem we're talking about is not to pollute the earth for people living now and then pretend you do that in the future. We're talking
about
making the world. But we're talking about doing things that make the world better or more profitable for everybody now, but ends up polluting the earth later.
Oh, well, that sort of thing just goes back to like hurting future generations, where I just kind of don't care.
And that's weird. And you recognize that that's weird. It's weird to say that I don't care about future generations.
I don't even know if I think it's that weird for me personally.
It's hard for me.
It's weird for me.
It is weird.
Yeah.
Because you have a sentimental attachment to humanity.
I feel like it's a responsibility.
I look at it kind of weird. Like in the short run. I this is one of those things where indirectly you help future generations, I think, because
you give them a new problem to solve.
Mm. Well, not really. It's not that so much as like you're...
Here's a bunch of radioactive waste.
Well,
deal with
like
it.
There's like a leading otherwise. Edge of concern you might have, where you might be concerned about your children. And I can see you being concerned about your children. And then I can see them being concerned about their children. Just like a leading edge where like it inadvertently makes the planet, I think
I can tell.
Okay.
I can tell that this is not going to be the brief discussion that we were looking for. So I'm just going to go ahead and throw out a thought experiment so that everybody can play around with this. Here's a thought experiment. Let's say that I could do something now, right now, that ended all poverty. It makes everybody on the planet employable, gives them a chain of things that they can do to improve their world and a way of making a living and supporting their families. Now, that would be a huge impact on the world. Yeah. Enormous. Let's say whatever it is that I did to do that would in 100 years guarantee that the planet was uninhabitable. Guaranteed. Impossible for a future generation to solve. Most of us are going to say that's
wrong.
Mm-hmm. And because of this problem with contractarianism, I don't see any way of characterizing it as wrong.
It doesn't really bother me.
Yeah, it doesn't bother me either. I'm kind of with Trevor on this one.
Really?
So do it. Your policy is do it.
I'm sentimental about... Well, sure, do it. It's silly, but it can't possibly happen. But for a thought experiment, what was I going to say? I mean, I'm sentimental about biodiversity, about the past, about the future. I feel that sense of responsibility, but really, we have, what, hundreds of billions of galaxies, an infinite vast variety of space. I mean, I'm worried about the particular future of this. It doesn't make sense to me to be invested in it. in the future of this planet or this species.
So you're saying do it, and in 100 years there are no humans or animals or anything.
Right.
Because we're not going to be able to migrate to another planet in just 100 years.
Sure.
Wow. I think that's weird.
Yeah.
So does Brittany.
It does.
So do you.
Now, if I were one of the future generations and they decided to instead endure until we could be spacefaring, I would be very appreciative. But, you know, hindsight's 20/20 when you get to exist. But, yeah, I can't think of a reason for it to bother me. Because really the things that make me sentimental about it are solved by the knowledge of an almost infinite diversity across the universe that, right, I don't know about.
Right.
Civilizations that die, civilizations that don't die.
Huh.
We're just one example of biodiversity, one result, one scenario.
Isn't that an argument from ignorance? Because we have not found any other evidence of life. Not even the most basic form of life.
True.
Are you just saying that human life is not possible, or all life on the planet is?
All life on the planet.
And so you think that zero biodiversity on the planet is...
Doesn't necessarily, your thought experiment doesn't bother me.
I guess what I value...
Nick is on board with...
look, eventually the sun is going to burn us out, okay? I mean, it's...
It's not just life.
If you're saying that you're going to guarantee for the next 100 years everyone is happy, and that's how they're all going to go out?
Uh-huh.
All right.
It's not just about life, either. Like, somebody talks about, let's just fill in the Grand Canyon. I think most people would feel, because we want to put down a highway, I think most people would object to that. Destroying a natural wonder. People are not just sentimental about the life part of it.
Just don't do it two weeks from now. I want to hike through it first.
We have sentiment about the diversity of...
That's a burden on
...of nature. And that diversity isn't confined to our single planet.
Right.
I value... I don't know. If that were a possible scenario within the universe... That is just as interesting as every other scenario to me. Does that make sense?
It does. It's just the answer doesn't.
To me, I feel like you are valuing great diversity in the universe, yet you're not valuing diversity on this planet. I feel like that's hypocritical.
Yeah. Well, I value
like
it.
Diversity, but not our diversity.
Yeah, but if you're, as far as we know, there's no life anywhere else.
Well, you're saying, so the
only
saying
place
that result,
where there is life is here, and it's an enormous diversity.
You're saying that result would be a decrease in diversity, and...
Well, by definition, it would be.
Yeah, because you'd be destroying...
Well, what do you mean? No, by definition it is. However much diversity there is in the universe, with the amount of diversity that's on the planet Earth, that number is enhanced. We're talking about ending all life on Earth.
I'm not talking about diversity in that sense. I'm talking about diversity in the sense that... Try to explain.
Of course, I would, as a sidebar, that I don't understand how to value diversity. Mm. Not cultural diversity.
I'm not using it quite...
Biodiversity?
I'm trying to explain...
That's, we wanted to do a thing later on that.
I'm not quite using diversity in that way, and I'm trying to explain the sense that I'm using it in.
You're saying we're insignificant. Our planet is insignificant.
Yeah, let's say that you could look at 100 different planets around the universe. Some of them are lifeless, some of them have oceans, some of them have life, some of them have civilizations, some of them were burned out by the sun. All of those things are interesting to me. I don't really see, well, that one has life, I value that one. They're all sort of interesting. So to say that I have an invested interest in a particular future scenario for a particular planet doesn't make sense, because my interest in it is passive and observational. I find the fate of things interesting.
I feel
so
that
life is interesting to me because of the way it carries out, and if it carries out one way or another.
So you're for nuclear war then?
Well, not right now.
It would be interesting.
I don't think it would be very interesting.
Well, why not?
I'm talking about relative to future generations, where I have no vested interest in my own needs. So I don't want humanity to end now.
No. You are abstracting yourself as an outside observer. You are abstracting yourself as an outside observer, and you said that the various things that go on planets is interesting whether there's life or not.
Well, that's because when you're thinking about...
If you're going to do that, then what's good for the goose is good for the gander.
If you're thinking about future generations...
Blowing up all of a sudden would be terribly interesting.
If you're thinking about future generations, you can't consider them as part of that moral sphere. So you have to see them as sort of a removed observer. And because of that, because I have no moral investment in the future generation, I can't think about it in terms of my own self-interest.
I gotcha.
Does that make sense?
Kind of.
It's kind of contrived.
Norm, do you want to hear how I really do give the future beyond me consideration? Hmm. Indirectly. I like history myself, personally. I just find it interesting. I love studying about people who used to exist.
Right.
I feel a weird sense of, it's just in my mind, but I feel like a weird sort of connectedness to that, to those people. I like reading words that people wrote down and hearing their thoughts. I like seeing what they built.
Right.
And, but I'm, you know, they built all those things, not for me, but they're there and I can study that. I like the idea. This reminds me of something you said to, I think, David Grinspoon, of that it just makes you, would make you feel like a shitty person, right, if you didn't consider that.
Yeah.
So I think it, for me, like, it makes me feel good knowing that someone, yeah, could study things that I did today later on.
I think that's
feel
a
that
solution.
Sense of connection.
I actually
but
agree.
That's, yeah, that's personally how I do this.
I think that's a solution.
So but it's indirect. You know, my connection is to the past. They're not connected to me, but I feel connected to that past.
Sure.
By studying it.
Sure.
And that's a connection I understand that a future generation will be able to feel to my current present later, and that someone might find that cool.
Yeah. Let me add something.
So for me, to me, that's how I care about the future. It's that, right, by my investment in the past and my connection to the past and wanting to study that, I think, well, like, look at those people left. They didn't leave it on purpose for me.
Sure.
But they left it there, and I could learn about it, and I, sure, like learning. So if I can leave something that's for these future generations to learn about and stuff, they might think that's kind of cool.
That makes you feel good
that
about
makes
your
feel
actions
good
now.
About my actions, yes, now, and that's fine. That's good enough for me.
I think it's even deeper than that. I think it's a character trait. I don't think...
again, it's a virtue.
I don't think that a citizen of a good society is someone who doesn't think about the future.
I agree.
And the reason is because the immediate future has a direct impact on all of us,
right,
because we have long lifespans,
yeah,
fairly. And also we might have children, and we want to feel like we have left something good for our children. And I don't think we want citizens who are willing to have children who don't care about the future. I think that would lead to having just a bad citizenry.
I agree.
Where people are too short-term thinking, they end up hurting themselves and others in their own lifespans. And so to me, the only connection this has is that, in general, a good citizen is someone who thinks about the future and who wants to leave things better than they had them.
So this kind of puts us in the same place we were with almost every other objection,
yes,
where you can't really explicitly say there's a moral obligation.
No, in this case, it makes no freaking sense.
And so that's why I feel like I have to bite the bullet in every case. But ultimately, in that context, I'm still going to behave consistently with caring about the future, because I do, whether I'm morally obligated to or not.
Right. Norm, you want a practical reason?
Yeah.
Here we go. As you get older, assuming you're living and you're having fun,
you care about what you left behind.
Eventually, you're going to get to a point where you need someone to wipe your behind. Now, that person might not be born yet. But you want the world to be able to produce someone who could wipe your behind and turn on fucking Matlock for you. It's going to be Doctor Who for us. That's our Matlock. But,
not for me.
Not for you, it's Trek. But that's okay. The point is, we want people to be able to wipe our asses when we get old.
Or robots.
So we can't destroy the future generations. And that's true. Trump will fix it. If we do
benevolent
have ass-wiping robots.
Ass-wiping robots.
I'm all for that. Yeah.
And they can live on a
robot stuff.
Oh, yeah. They can have a built-in bidet. They can, yeah.
Well,
they
even have to have, that's not weird at all.
They don't even have to have the ability to sense smell.
I'm okay with it.
You don't have to tip.
That won't be even a problem for them.
That's right.
So, yes. I will say that with that caveat.
And you can beat
them
at night.
They might be able to diagnose our health problems from the smell.
Look at that.
That's true.
Like a dog.
So that's what I'll say, Norm. So unless we invent ass-wiping robots, you might need a person to wipe your ass someday. So you should care about future generations.
Yeah, so it's a general character trait that
I feel
is
like
positive.
This is the most selfish moral discussion I have ever heard in my life.
Well, it's interesting because in terms
society's
of...
Society's ass.
In terms
right,
of
right.
moral obligation, it is extremely selfish, but...
Societal diarrhea.
Unlike a lot of other moral theories, you don't have to stop at the point where you've... Just because you don't have a moral obligation to do something doesn't mean you can't do it anyway, and that it's a bad thing to do.
Yeah, it's just...
That might be more of a character thing.
Right.
Yeah. We're talking about, or the virtue ethics.
It's like a secondary...
I do give a lot of credence to the idea that future generations should not be considered on par with current generations. That it is I think it's morally permissible to leave certain problems to future generations if they do make our lives better now. And nuclear power is probably a good example. If you do nuclear power properly, you don't actually leave that much waste. But you do leave some.
So you don't think we should build another one on a fault line next to a tsunami?
Maybe not on a fault line next to the coasts. That might not be wise.
That's why we don't give a shit about the national debt.
But regardless, I'm all for nuclear power, and I solve this problem as far as sending this problem down the line to future generations in that they're going to have greater capacity than us technologically. Right. And they're going to have it on the backs of being able to form energy, so that's what we're doing. So in a way, yes, we're giving the future some problems to deal with, but we're also ensuring that they have the means of dealing with them.
Right. I mean, let's face it. At this point, your phone is almost a tricorder.
Yeah.
So they're going to get the actual track order, and we're not. Yeah. That does piss me off a little bit.
It does.
So I do resent the future a little bit.
There's already technology.
I think that's healthy.
Right, Norm? Fuck them. They're going to get starships and everything. Gosh.
There's already technology that talks about repurposing nuclear waste.
Yeah.
I mean, it's radioactive. It's emitting energy.
Right.
It does stuff.
Yeah.
There are proposed reactors that could burn 95% of it.
Breeder
reactors.
And then
that also that leftover 5%, burn that too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that, I mean that's the way nuclear reactors work now is simply legacy. It was a kind of almost arbitrary marketing based choice a long time ago, and we just went with it. There's no reason we have to. No. But anyway, I think so. To wrap this discussion up, because we are going a fairly long on time, I think that these kinds of considerations are interesting. They're interesting to talk about, and we're at an hour and 30 something minutes.
Yeah.
They're interesting. They're difficult.
Norm, we're not concerned about future people who listen to it.
Yeah.
This is one of my favorite subjects to discuss.
Yeah. What is?
Social contract.
Yeah. Oh,
it's been one of my favorites. Yeah.
What?
Okay.
And the latter ethics episodes have been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, I think we can leave social contract here because I think that it's well equipped to deal with these fringe issues. It does challenge the way we think a bit. I think that the natural reaction that people have to the moral considerability of the mentally handicapped or infants who are handicapped is understandable, but actually results in bad things in society. And so I think that this is a way that we could progress.
Yeah.
So I like a moral theory that is forward-looking, and I think it is. But I don't think that it actually has as big of a problem handling these things as people think it does.
Me neither. Again, like a lot of people don't like the I use a lot of indirect consideration.
Sure.
And I know that bothers some people, but we talked about indirect doesn't mean less.
Yeah.
And oftentimes.
So it means more, as you pointed out. I never really thought of. So, yeah.
I oftentimes feel like the tendency to say, no, I feel like that's wrong, is not a rational objection.
They're saying no, that makes you feel bad.
That's just the door opener. I feel like that's wrong. Let's consider it a little more.
Right. And so. If you really break it down, it's kind of hard to justify that because it's an emotive sense rather than a rational one.
Right.
Let's just wrap by saying once again, please don't harm infants. These are thought experiments.
Yes.
You can harm as many infants. I hate those fucking.
Are we all satisfied?
I think so. Trauma, you are never allowed to babysit my children. My future kids who don't exist.
That's a wise
decision.
You have
no responsibility to them, though.
That's true.
All right. That is my phone playing the exact theme song. We're crazy. So I think we're done with this. I think we can move on to some of the other moral problems. So I think we are going to pick up the ethics series and talk about I think on the agenda is gun control.
Ooh. Gun control.
I've been doing it for like a couple of years now.
Drug legalization is going to be on there. We're doing this podcast from Colorado, so that seems apropos. Mm. And I think we also...
We should record it high.
We should just experiment on that.
Yeah,
too.
Let's see how it goes.
Just to be genuine.
No, it probably wouldn't.
Maybe. But anyway, we're going to have more topics. As always, I appreciate the discussion.
That was great.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Awesome.
Thanks for leading us through it. So everyone out there listening to Podcast Slam, please think responsibly, but not about future people.
Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
An obscure body in the SK system, Your Majesty. The inhabitants refer to it as the planet Earth.
How peaceful it looks.
Thank you.
Most effective, Your Majesty. We'll destroy this earth.
Later. I like to play with things a while before annihilation.